We all drink from the same glass of water, and whether it's ag or rec or municipal means.
What am I doing for my community today that's going to benefit all of them?
In 2015, the first iteration of the Colorado Water Plan was signed into being by then-Governor John Hickenlooper. It encompassed regional plans by the nine roundtables of Colorado, known as the Basin Implementation Plans, or BIP. These grassroots efforts prioritized projects for their basins and approved basin goals, thereby contributing to the major goals and outcomes outlined in the Colorado Water Plan. After 5 years of funding and implementing projects to meet those goals, it's now time for another update. Colorado is facing serious challenges to water quantity, quality, management, and overall watershed health. Through the efforts of the nine roundtables, the water plan is again defining what it will take to meet these challenges through scientific data analysis and local needs and priorities. Projects will continue to form the backbone of the roundtable's efforts to meet local and state goals. In the Rio Grande Basin, in just the past 5 years, there have been dozens of projects ranging from agricultural, municipal and industrial, water administration, education and outreach, and environmental and recreation. You can see these projects on our website, www.rgbrt.org. They're all really amazing. And now we're gearing up for another 5 years of projects that will put our newly updated basin goals, also available for viewing on our website, into practice throughout the San Luis Valley. On this episode of the Big River Podcast, Stories of the Rio Grande, we'll dive deeper into a couple of the new project proposals concentrating on agriculture water conservation and municipal water use, and talk with Daniel Boyce from the Rio Grande Headwaters Restoration Project, who is also the Rio Grande Basin's local expert. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for joining us today, Daniel. I'm really excited to have a chance to really talk about the Basin Implementation Plan because it's something that you have been working on for a long time, but people across Colorado are working on and have been for really the past 5 years.
So I studied environmental science with really a focus in water resources. And so that sort of led me into my current career path. Through the course of those different positions, I landed eventually in Taos, New Mexico, working for the Bureau of Land Management field office there. Doing basically river health assessments on the Rio Grande in New Mexico and its various tributaries in northern New Mexico. And during that position, I got to know some of the folks who work here in the San Luis Valley, for example, Emma Reeser, my current boss, and found out about a position with the Restoration Project. When I wrapped up with BLM, in Taos, I ended up moving to the Valley to work with Emma and the Restoration Project. I was really happy working on the Rio Grande in New Mexico, and so it was great to be able to literally move upstream and just work on the Rio Grande in the Valley. Certainly since moving to the San Luis Valley, I've learned so much about, Colorado as a state has very, specific water resources management policies and laws and sort of practices. Even within the San Luis Valley, we have our own very specific, regionally specific water management practices. So I've learned a lot just living here.
So can you talk a little bit and give us a little background on what being a local expert for the BIP means?
Yeah, so each basin roundtable selected a local expert to facilitate and manage and really see through to completion the update of the 2015 Basin Implementation Plans. And so the intention there, the way it was set up was there is a sort of general contracting team at the state level that's overseeing the Colorado Water Plan update and really is there as a resource to each basin as they update their basin implementation plans, but they really, it was set up such that, you know, that they felt that it was important that someone locally was really driving the basin implementation plans. And so, you know, the restoration project, I think, fits that role really well. We've been around since 2001, and we have been really active in the roundtable. And so really, the restoration project as the local expert, I think, made a lot of sense. We have the capacity to be that facilitator. And as you said, certainly we, you know, as an organization and sort of between us and all of our partner organizations, I think that we have a pretty deep understanding of the basin challenges and local issues that really need to be addressed. And I think we're able to kind of make sure that everyone is involved in the BIP update process.
So there is that continuity across the state. What a big difference from the last time to this time is projects and how we're going to prioritize those and tier them. So would you walk us through what we can expect from that process?
And really that idea to prioritize projects, it really came from the roundtables. So in throughout really all of 2019, CWCB led an implementation working group to sort of scope out what the roundtables around the state wanted the update to their basin implementation plans and the update to the Colorado Water Plan to look like. And one of the things that came out of that was the need to really prioritize the top basin needs in terms of projects. The way we're going about that is, you know, we're certainly accepting every project as long as there's enough sort of information to describe the project. We're sort of accepting it and incorporating it into the BIP update. But we are taking the time to go through a process of prioritizing those projects based on, you know, how well aligned they are with our basin's goals. Mm-hmm. That the basin roundtables develop, how well they're aligned with the Colorado Water Plan, really how critical they are to meeting our basin's water needs. And I think our roundtable and the consensus around the state was that is a really important process to go through so that we really are funding projects through the roundtable that are going to have the greatest impact and that are meeting the most sort of water needs.
And those are projects that are across all of the five kind of focus areas, right? So environmental and rec and municipal and industrial. Are you seeing?
Yeah, well, as you said, certainly they're, the projects really span a wide range of different sort of water resources management needs, all the way from, say, a water infrastructure project, looking at installing, you know, a new wastewater system, for example, all the way to, you know, restoring headwater streams for native fish. And, you know, so they really are all across that spectrum. And I'm really personally really excited by all the really neat and innovative projects that have been submitted so far. And, you know, we're not done with that process yet. And I think we're going to have a really great list of projects that we can feel really good about and that are really going to help us meet our future water needs.
Do you feel like those are going to make a real, like, quantifiable difference to our basin's water use and the way that we allocate water across different user groups?
Absolutely. I do think so. You know, I think one of the biggest challenges in terms of our water security in this basin is really just water availability. Mm-hmm. So the availability of surface water and groundwater supplies, and that's something that is a huge focus of the BIP update, of the roundtable, and of these projects. And people are submitting projects, and the BIP committees are developing strategies that I think will have a quantifiable impact and sort of mitigate future stressors in terms of water availability. So things like updating irrigation diversions have a quantifiable impact on and have a water saving. you know, if you're able to more efficiently divert water, you know, water managers across the basin are able to administer things like the Rio Grande Compact more efficiently. And that helps really everyone. And it really helps us plan in terms of meeting stream flow needs where we can and meeting the compact in an efficient way, you know, and other, you know, infrastructural upgrades to, you know, water storage have a quantifiable impact. And by either creating new storage opportunities or improving the ones that are in the basin, we're helping sort of make sure that we'll have future water supplies for municipalities, which is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good thing for people to think about if they're not part of water projects. You know, if you're a regular person going about your day, you're not necessarily thinking about water storage, those kinds of projects, and then quality of life projects, because it seems like, especially if you're looking at the basin goals, which people are welcome to see on the website, and those were modified from our previous basin goals. And so our goals now encompass a lot of possibilities, and mm-hmm. a lot of that encompasses quality of life. So would you talk a little bit about some of the projects that are going to affect the quality of life in the valley?
You know, I think one of the biggest draws that bring people to the valley, you know, as people who live here know, is outdoor recreation. And I would say a lot of the projects, whether directly or indirectly, and some of the strategies, even if they're not specific projects, but some of the strategies that are coming out of the BIP update will have a really positive benefit for recreation. So river related recreation, we're talking about, you know, opportunities to put in new boating access sites. Mm-hmm. And you know, even so indirectly, some of the native species conservation, for example, Rio Grande cutthroat trout has a really huge impact for recreation, because a lot of folks, you know, really enjoy and will go to specific destinations to fish for those native trout. And so, yeah, there's just a variety of different projects that really have an impact on the recreational opportunities that people have access to here.
Deacon Aspinwall is with the City of Alamosa as their GIS analyst, working with water management. On behalf of the city, three project proposals centering around municipal water management have been submitted to the roundtable. They focus on improving turf irrigation for the municipal golf course, reevaluating the levee system next to the Rio Grande as it flows through Alamosa, and updating aging water infrastructure within city limits.
Water is such an integral issue, so it's cool to have a some sort of a role in managing some of these resources sustainably.
So you weren't part of the last Basin Implementation Plan project kind of gathering, which I was not either. So we're both fairly new to this particular process that other people have gone through 5 years ago. Can you walk me through kind of when you were seeing this call for projects? And I know you were part of the municipal and industrial kind of subcommittee that was meeting. Why did these projects that you have put up jump to the forefront of your mind as really good fits with the Basin Implementation Plan?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. And just to kind of jump off a little bit, I know that when the last BIP update was going on, you know, the industrial and municipal needs were not really well established. Mm-hmm. There just wasn't high resolution data for what the existing needs are. And so a lot of that was based on some very well-educated guesses. But I think under this BIP process, we've got better data to really flesh out some of those needs. You know, we all drink from the same glass of water, and whether it's ag or rec or municipal needs, you know, we all share a role in that. And so as the city, you know, kind of looks to the future, you know, really everywhere in Colorado is growing. And we're certainly seeing growth in our community of Alamosa. And so when we, you know, look at our, you know, short-term and long-term needs, really these BIP projects were highlighted just out of the sheer necessity to to make sure that we are building a Alamosa that's sustainable and delivers the needs of municipal residents. So sort of how do we build a sustainable society?
I think the three of the projects that we're going to kind of highlight here do a really great job of illustrating that broader mindset that the city of Alamosa seems to have been really working towards in the last at least 7 to 5 years, with looking at the not only the residential use of water, but how people recreate around the city using water. And some of that comes into play with the levee recertification one. So I want to kind of talk about that one first, if you don't mind. And so what's going on with the levees, and why is this project, why do you feel like this project is so necessary for the city right now?
Well, I think the levee project is really a great one to highlight, because it's while, you know, we're submitting it from a municipal and industrial need, it has tie-ins to watershed health and the environment and recreation and ag and critical infrastructure. So it's got all these things that are really important. So the levee system was created or constructed really between the mid 80s and the mid 90s. Army Corps engineers come through, they build this levee system in order to protect, you know, the city from flooding. And, you know, historically Alamosa experienced quite a few, you know, flood events. I think there was a pretty notable one in 1927 or something like that. And so in order to, you know, protect the city, you know, Army Corps of Engineers builds this levee. And time goes on, and our understanding of, you know, maybe engineering solutions changes. You know, Hurricane Katrina, you know, in 2003 or four, you know, that changed a lot of standards. And so as we're working on making sure that our levee is up to snuff and that it still is meeting the level of protection that's required by both FEMA and the Army Corps, you know, there's certainly been some things that have been highlighted. So, you know, back when levees were constructed 25, 35 years ago, thing that they did to support the stabilization of those levee banks was to plant trees. Well, we all know after Hurricane Katrina came through and knocked over trees in the levee and it blew a bunch of big holes into the levee and kind of realized, well, shoot, maybe that's not the best idea. So part of this recertification process is looking at, okay, what are things that we need to do to enhance the levee's ability to protect, you know, the city and its infrastructure and its citizens? So a lot of these pieces of infrastructure, you know, involve, you know, what sort of routine maintenance needs to be happening, what sort of major maintenance needs to be happening. And, you know, there's quite a bit of modeling that goes into it as well. And with modern computing power, it's certainly more robust than in the mid 80s.
With the use of more hardcore data to support these projects and why they're needed. So that's a cool difference. I wanted to ask you really, for people who might be pushing back a little and saying, well, you know, Hurricane Katrina, that took place on the coast. It had a hurricane. We don't, you know, traditionally see hurricanes in the San Luis Valley. So why do we need to be so concerned about our levees? What would you push back with people who'd say, well, you know, the odds of us having a historic flood event are very slim to none. So why should we bother doing this type of project here in the valley when we look like we're having drier conditions more than anything else?
You know, I actually asked the same question to FEMA. And so I'll kind of pass along what they told me when I asked the same question. Mm-hmm. And that was, well, there's a couple of things. One is the regulations that the federal regulations that kind of govern what is a levee system are pretty black and white. It's not a lot of flexibility. Mm. But the other thing is nobody thinks they need flood infrastructure until after a flood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly we have not had those high water events that we've had typically historically, you know, with the aquifer drawdown and declining snowpack and all these other different factors. I think that the data certainly shows that we are not seeing those high flood events that we historically used to see. However, that doesn't mean that these flood events are still not possible. And, you know, I think the spring of 2019 was a really great example. So we had a very high water year level. The levee system did fantastic, but it certainly does highlight some of the things that are concerned. Looking at the railroad trust just downstream of town, it's pretty low to the water, and it you know, was able to capture quite a bit of debris and trees and things like that. So, you know, if that punches a hole in the levee, well, does it flood part of East Alamosa? Or, you know, so there's a lot of these questions that analysis is really crucial.
The intersection, like you mentioned, of recreation and looking at the environment, this project kind of ticks those boxes as well. And with all of these projects needing to kind of meet and fit under the umbrella of the broader basin goals, I know that there are a couple of other projects that are happening right in that area of the Alamosa River corridor with, you know, boat ramps and wanting to put in some better access points for recreation. And so it seems kind of a no-brainer that, guess you would want your levee system able to take on that kind of higher traffic flow from people and equipment and other things that are impacting the river at those points.
That's a great example. And you know, just to kind of add to the environmental and recreational piece, there's also the kind of compact obligations. So the levee system acts as a bottleneck for the river. You know, it's kind of meandering and it's chugging along and it gets to the levee system and it really bottlenecks. And a limiting capacity for water to get transported downstream to fulfill compact obligations happens here in Alamosa. But on the flip side, one of the things that's also happened is, you know, because the river is really not acting as a natural river system does, we've seen increased siltation in the riparian corridor. We've seen, you know, decreased stream flows. And, you know, when we talk about all the riparian habitat, you know, especially as, you know, fish passage, that decreased sinuosity of the river has really allowed for a less efficient transport of sediment. So when we think about putting all of these pieces together, the levee acts as a bottleneck. It fills up with sediment, which decreases the capacity that the levee system can, the flood that levee system can protect against. It also decreases the availability to get water through the city and downstream to meet compact obligations. Mm-hmm. And that siltation does create some environmental you know, sore spots in a sense.
Yeah, thank you for bringing up the compact, because that is that everyone working with water in the valley has that kind of in the back of their head of how is the way that I am using water going to impact our actual federal legal obligations to the downstream states. Absolutely. So when we're looking at kind of all these projects, and I wish I could spend forever just talking about all of them, but in the interest of time, just kind of looking at all three of these projects, the major infrastructure update with looking at stormwater quality and this levee recertification and how to improve efficiencies for turf irrigation, particularly around the golf course. What do you see as really big challenges that you're facing or that the city of Alamosa is facing with trying to get these kinds of projects off the ground?
You know, I think that there's a handful. One is the bottom of the San Luis Valley is really flat, which, you know, is kind of a no-brainer, but from an infrastructure side, it presents quite a few challenges, mm-hmm. Especially when we're talking about storm water and also talking about sanitary sewer. So as we think from an industrial or a municipal side, you know, the city really can only essentially grow to the west. Well, our wastewater treatment plant is to the east. So how do you get all of that sanitary waste, you know, from the west side to the east side when it's flat? That presents just a straight engineering challenge. When you add on top of that, well, how do you return stormwater into the river and make sure that it's clean and it's, you know, has a as good of a water quality as we can deliver back to the river? And so once again, with it being so flat, it's hard to get water to flow, you know, back into the river and return it. Mm-hmm. So historically, that I would say that the solution has been to have retention ponds that just, you know, you lose all that stormwater essentially to evaporation. So I think that's one of the major challenges, mm-hmm. is just the geography. The other thing is aging infrastructure. So pipe is not cheap and it only gets more expensive. And we've got, you know, geez, probably about 150 miles of pipe within the city. And when you're talking, you know, an average cost of about 50 bucks a foot, it's hard to replace that aging infrastructure. And so that has implications on water delivery, on, you know, getting your stormwater or sanitary sewer, you know, evacuated. Also has, you know, consequences on the rec side for how do you maintain a park, you know, that is fun to be in and fun to recreate in, but also not taking just acres and acres and acres feet of water to irrigate.
If we flipped and said, okay, well, we recognize that these are some challenges that you're facing. I think especially the challenges to aging infrastructure is something that's pretty common to almost all parts of the United States at this point, as people are seeing the breakdown. The flip side, so the benefit to the community of these projects, what would you want people to walk away from thinking if they had to support those projects or if they knew more about them, what would you want them to think about as the major benefits to their community?
So I know for myself personally, before working for the city, it's easy to take for granted that you turn your tap on and you've got clean water, or that you flush your toilet and, you know, it goes away. And so, you know, it's sometimes one of those out of sight, out of mind. Mm-hmm. However, I think that's the biggest thing is that in order to have efficient utility services that are, you know, not astronomically expensive and also don't have negative impacts on the environment, you know, just to digress a little bit, when you've got aging infrastructure, whether it's, you know, your sanitary lines, you know, if you've got old lines that have cracks in them, well, some of that waste can seep out. That's not good for anybody. On the flip side, on the water conservation side, if you've got old pipes that are leaking, well, you're wasting water that you're pumping up out of the confined aquifer and then treating and then delivering it to the homes. All of that is being lost through, you know, maybe faulty joints or cracks in pipe. And that's also not great.
Right. And I think that we have come to a point in our society where we that luxury of not thinking about where your water's coming from or how we're using every drop is that luxury is gone now with the realities that we're facing. There is a cost, whether that's a utility cost or there's an environmental or other type of less tangible cost. So to kind of recap and to kind of go back to the Basin Implementation Plan, the city had these projects in mind. Was it a helpful tool to have this Basin Implementation Plan for your projects to go into a place for potential funding? Would this have been more difficult, I guess, to accomplish these projects that I'm sure the city had been thinking about for a while? Would it be more difficult for you to accomplish those without this Basin Implementation Plan and Colorado Water Plan kind of behind all of it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you hit it on the head when you're talking about just kind of putting pencils to paper and thinking about, well, what is it going to take to recertify the levee, or what is it going to take to replace aging infrastructure? What's it going to take to make sure that we have a sustainable water supply or we can grow sustainably? And I think the other really neat thing about the Basin Implementation Plan is that, you know, sometimes our different expertises are siloed. People who are in the ag community, they've got their own focus. Mm-hmm. People who are in a municipal sort of setting have their own focus and so on. But I think what the Basin Implementation Plan does really well is that it highlights how interconnected all of these issues are, and that when you do something to address a recreational objective, you're actually helping out an economic objective and a agricultural objective.
Judy Lopez is the San Luis Valley Program Manager for Colorado Open Lands, one of the largest conservation easement organizations in the state. Judy has worked tirelessly over the past 5 years on behalf of the agricultural community, particularly with the Acequia Associations in Costilla County. She is a former public school teacher a former executive director of the Rio Grande Watershed Conservation and Education Initiative, the first Rio Grande Public Education Participation and Outreach Liaison, and was part of the first BIP process. She has spent the past several months working on a water conservation easement project in partnership with other conservation and water organizations.
So Judy, would you talk a little bit about what it is that you do with Colorado Open Lands and then this particular project that you're hoping to get into this next round of basin implementation plan projects?
You bet, Bethany. Thanks for including me. It's really awesome. I'm the Conservation Project Manager for Colorado Open Lands here in the San Luis Valley. CRL's a statewide land trust, so we work with landowners all across the state in a variety of land, in a variety of landscapes. It's the pace of conservation, especially over the last probably 8 or 10 years, has picked up dramatically. I think folks are developing that broader conservation ethic and the value that open space brings to their lives. Certainly, one of the biggest contributors to that open space is rural farm and ranch land. And we both work and treasure the folks that are working the land throughout any of the spaces that we're working to conserve properties.
This particular project, would you talk me through like just a description of it, and then why is it so innovative? What's unusual about it?
So this project started in a conversation between Alan Law with Rio Grande Headwaters Land Trust and now Senator-elect Cleve Simpson, who's the general manager of the Rio Grande Water Conservation District. And as most folks know, we have some aquifer decline issues that we're needing to resolve. And certainly that's become more pressing in the last couple of years as we've seen reduced snowfall and reduced moisture that are coming in. So the idea was, could we create another tool in the toolbox and possibly use land conservation easements to help in that aquifer replenishment? What Colorado Open Lands did is we partnered with Wright because we've done a lot of work on the Front Range in working through alternative transfer mechanisms, mitigation banking with water, and set out to kind of develop a model. Last year and a half, we've been working with conservation easement attorneys, water attorneys, conservation easement appraisers, of course, the sub-districts to develop conservation easement that would restrict the right to pump wells. So the project that's innovative that's been we're including in the basin implementation plan are groundwater conservation easements. These easements will recognize the value of restoring the aquifer, and that by taking some land out of agricultural production, we're really improving the long-term sustainability of the farming and ranching communities here in the valley. So this project will work to fund easements that could either permanently restrict groundwater pumping or either in whole or in parts, say maybe from 30 to 100% of that, and still allow those landowners, those agricultural producers, to still work their lands and stay on the land. I think the beauty of the conservation easement is it allows us to tailor that easement specific to what a landowner is looking at in the long term.
Is anyone else doing anything like this in Colorado? Or is this like the first really, I feel like it's the very first groundbreaking approach to conservation with water the way that it's been done with land, that no one else in Colorado is really doing this at this level yet?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Bethany. This is a first. So this is the first time the conservation easement tool has been used in this way. And its benefit to landowners, the sub-districts, water managers, the potential is unlimited.
Have there been private landowners and ranchers and farmers already who have been interested in putting this into place with their properties?
Our first stop along this journey was to get a cadre of water partners. So definitely Rio Grande Water Conservation District, Heather with the San Luis Valley Water Conservancy District, and Nathan Combs with the Canales Water Conservancy District have been so instrumental in developing what this tool could look like. One of the things that we really wanted to understand, though, was when would landowners find it useful? If it was out there, would they utilize it? So Alan and I spent several nights, several days, several meetings with landowners in each sub-district. And, you know, to kind of say, what would you need the terms to be like for you to really say, yep, I want to do that? And so overall, yes, we've had private landowners, we've had large landowners, small landowners that have come to us and that are waiting in the queue to really see how this could work on their property.
Was the impetus for this was when we were starting to feel that that water export was really becoming an actual reality that we would have to fight against with that renewable water resources trying to buy up water rights so that they could then export water out of the valley. And so the Colorado Open Lands and Rights response to the struggles that are real here in the valley that would make people want to sell their water so that they could continue to live.
You're exactly right, Bethany. Yeah, that's exactly part of the purpose. You know, I think farmers and ranchers as a community are really tight-knit, and they definitely value the resources that it takes to have a successful operation. But the last few years with these weather swings that we've seen, the ongoing drought, the ups and downs have really made profitability for farming and ranching really marginal. And so I think that this provides an opportunity for that financial support and also ensures and allows those farmers and ranchers that participate to do it with the knowledge that the water that they retire is going to stay here in the valley, that they're helping their own communities stay viable.
I don't think that anyone who has lived in the valley for generations and has those ties to the land and water would do something like that unless they were really pushed to it. So it's really amazing that you guys have thought of an alternative to really try to think outside the box and to come up with solutions with all of the things that we're facing, besides just us in the Rio Grande looking at a water export, but all of these issues with climate change and forest health. And it's really great to see that actually happening.
Had a super great response from landowners and agency partners about trying to get these things done. And I really think that this is a tool that helps the real heroes of this battle, and that's those ag producers that are trying to make a living in these crazy times. You know, one ag producer told Alan and I, our outreach meetings, you know, he's like, this is how we support our families. This is how our kids go to college. You know, we see our the next generation of our family staying with the land. Farmers and ranchers, and we want a farm and we want a ranch. And hopefully this is a tool that can help them continue to do that.
Yeah, I appreciate you continuing to use the term tool and toolbox and to kind of keep that image in our minds of providing some flexibility, because I think often it feels like you get stuck into a corner. It's frightening. And a lot of the stuff that's happening is beyond our individual control. And so you can tend to feel very boxed in. And it's wonderful to see that you and Alan and others are really trying to think of ways to offer another way to look at something, and that flexibility, and say, hey, this tool maybe didn't work in this one, but here's another one that we've got ready for you if it fits with you. And I appreciate that a lot.
Well, thanks, Bethany. Really appreciate that. And I think, you know, if there's anything that we've learned in the water community and the resource community over the last several years, is that this isn't a one size fits all issue. And so You know, we got to have a lot of willingness to be pretty open-minded and really do the hard work to understand what works and what doesn't work.
So with this type of project, what do you foresee being, and what have you already seen, as some of the greatest challenges that you are facing with this?
I think probably some of the biggest challenges with a conservation easement is that they are highly regulated. They have a very confined set of rules, of guidelines that you have to fit in. Conservation easements aren't just for the private landowner's benefit, but they have to really be able to show public benefit. Finally, the biggest piece is really trying to understand what each subdistrict needs in order to meet their plans of replacement and their long-term sustainability. It does no good for us to pay a landowner a lot of money if we're not going to get some return. If that isn't truly going to benefit the aquifer issues, then there's no point in doing this. And, you know, thank God for Craig Cotton and his group really helping us wrap our mind about around where that benefit begins and ends and how we can maximize that benefit for everybody.
So Craig Cotton being the Division III water engineer, for those who may not be as familiar, although they should, because he is really incredible. And so you kind of answered another question that I had for you about the benefits to the community, because it sounds like the challenges wrapped up with getting this kind of project off the ground is to prove that there are benefits to the community with the subdistricts and aquifer sustainability that you mentioned. Are there any other benefits that the community as a whole do you think will see from this type of project?
I think there's a few things that the community will see. We're an agricultural economy. Agriculture supports everything else that falls down from that. You know, we have local businesses, we have our school districts, and we have some great agency partners that work in and around agriculture in order to meet their resource needs. And so if we're not supporting that ag economy, I think what we begin to see is a domino effect. We lose it in folks attending our schools. We lose it with our agency folks. The impacts began to kind of ripple out. I know you've done a lot of work in helping folks understand the connection of water to the recreation community. If we can sustain that aquifer, we're not only sustaining habitats, but we're also sustaining the reasons why people come and enjoy the valley in the first place. And that's because of a diverse set of recreational assets.
I was going to say, because the idea is not that when you conserve water, you have a water easement on a property, that means that water stays on that property, and it never leaves. It's water is continually moving, and you have that water flow through that land and that property, going down into the groundwater to replenish the aquifer, but also going into streams and creeks and providing wetland habitat, and then, you know, being part of the water cycle and going back up again and then starting all over a snowpack. And so it's a continuously moving piece that we are still trying to keep our part of the basin healthy, that water involved in our watershed cycle.
You're exactly right. I think the benefit of us being able to replenish our aquifer and work towards that is so multifaceted that it's worth everything we have. Anything that anybody can give to this effort is going to end well. It's just going to end well.
That projects like yours are just a piece of that connection, where there's other projects that we'll talk about. Each one is so integral to the overall success. And so I appreciate the hard work that you have put in and others to be cognizant that you are part of a process and part of a bigger picture and a working towards a goal. Are there any other takeaways that you would want people to think about with this particular project, or conservation easements in general, or the work that you do that you wish that people kind of knew more about?
I think the biggest piece for me in my work here, every day when I turn on the computer, but I look out the window and I think, what am I doing for my community today that's going to benefit all of them? This is my home, and I want my home to be the very best place it can be. And I don't think we live in a better place where conservation is on the tips of everybody's tongue. And I think people ought to really, really be thankful for the group of folks that participate in these conversations in working towards these issues, because, man, there are a lot of great folks, and everybody's valuable.
Now that I had a chance to gain some more understanding around a couple of the projects that will hopefully be considered in the next couple of years for implementation, I wanted to follow up with Daniel and finish our conversation regarding the Basin Implementation Plan here in the Rio Grande Basin, and also what that was going to look like across the rest of the state.
Why the basin implementation process is such a big deal, not only for our basin, but for other basins, because across Colorado, we're looking at these challenges of climate change. And I know that was part of the process with the technical update meetings, was to continually kind of look at these potential scenarios for what might be in Colorado's future. What did you think about that scenario process, and how do you think it affects us here in the Valley?
So there are five different possible future scenarios that were developed and contemplated as part of the technical update. And, you know, theoretically, any of them are equally plausible. And I think it's really helpful for the planning process to consider how those future scenarios might play out and what that means in terms of, especially in terms of water availability, because that's one of the main things mm-hmm. that those scenarios are able to sort of adjust is to say, okay, if we do see a hot and dry future where we are getting less precipitation and we're seeing higher temperatures, what does that mean for our stream flows? And if indeed we see, you know, a percentage decrease in annual volume of flow, or we see a decrease in peak runoff, you know, how do we plan for that? I think they're very helpful for all of the stakeholders to think about and to come up with scenarios that might allow us to meet our water needs and our you know, recreational needs as well under the different scenarios. So I find it very helpful.
And one of the other things that I think is good to point out for people who haven't been part of the technical update process, that this process is extremely data-driven. That it's not people just kind of coming up with, oh, these scenarios look like fun, let's throw them in the hopper and see what sticks. There was a lot of data and analysis, and there will continue to be that as part of the process.
That's, yes, absolutely. And I'm glad you said that and mentioned that. It's really true. The general contracting team, along with CWCB staff, really spent a significant amount of time looking at different potential climate change scenarios, for example, and used that data to develop these future planning scenarios in terms of, you know, some of the numbers within that technical update, for example, stream flows, groundwater withdrawals, and crop irrigation requirements, et cetera. That's all hard data from stream gauges, and you know, all of that data is being collected by our basin and by the state, and it's definitely hard data that went into that technical update.
I'm really excited about that potential for continuing to add to our data and our knowledge bases with this technical update and with looking at the potential scenarios, because I think at the end of the day, it's all going to come down to, well, what are the hard facts for us to be able to make potentially hard decisions about water management and resource allocation in the future. So it's super helpful to have those tools being developed. And I really just want people to be really aware that those are out there and they're being very utilized through this process. So what makes you feel really good about this process? How do you feel this has been going? What kind of keeps you feeling positively and charged up about being part of this process?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really interesting and exciting process to be a part of. And I think for me, it's really just the people I've had the pleasure of working with throughout this process. And really, since I've been working in the basin, all these really neat and innovative ideas, many of them I would not have thought of. There's a lot of people who have really unique perspectives and ideas that are so encouraging to me. Mm-hmm. And make me feel like we really do have a chance at meeting our water needs effectively for all of our different water users and for, you know, recreation and the environment and agriculture and our municipalities and industrial water uses. Being involved and having conversations with all of these different groups keeps me going. While we're definitely well along the road in terms of doing this basin implementation plan update, I'd encourage, you know, anyone who's listening who's interested to get involved. We're still developing this basin plan, and that it's, you know, it's been an exciting process, and it has been really encouraging to me to see how innovative we can be when we work together to think about, you know, really creative and cutting edge solutions to some of our water issues. So this process is very worthwhile.
Thank you again to Daniel, Judy, and Deacon for giving us a closer look at the exciting opportunities afforded by the Basin Implementation Plan and the Colorado Water Plan. We are, as always, grateful for the partnership of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, not only through this basin planning process, but in helping to fund projects like this podcast. I encourage you to check out their website, engagecwcb.org, to see what other projects are happening throughout Colorado. We'll end with another Did You Know? This one in honor of the freezing winter season we're currently experiencing. Did you know that around this date, in mid to late December of 1848, explorer John C. Fremont led an expedition across the Sangre de Cristo Range into the San Luis Valley, wandering south towards Taos, New Mexico. Unsurprisingly, as anyone who has experienced winter in the San Luis Valley can tell you, the extreme freezing temperatures and snow created such hazardous conditions that 10 members of Fremont's expedition died, with another 15 saved only by the efforts of another member's efforts to reach Taos for supplies and return. The rest of the party eventually made it to Taos, and Fremont went on to make other expeditions and rise to political prominence. Happy holidays to you and yours from the Rio Grande Basin Roundtable. Stay warm.